Amos Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. Last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi unveiled a health care plan that she said would cover 96% of Americans and would offer a public option paid for with negotiated rates, among other provisions. On the Senate side of Congress, Majority Leader Harry Reid is working on a compromise bill that would allow states to opt out of a government-run option. President Obama has called for health care legislation that offers choice regardless of pre-existing conditions, quality health care, and a system that reins in rising costs. Now the Democratic leadership in Congress begins the hard work of coming up with a bill that can pass both chambers and be signed by the president. Republicans, except for Senator Olympia Snowe, have mostly been critical of the Democrats' plans and have offered their own proposals. Well, here to flesh out the bills in the House and the Senate is Mary Agnes Carey. She's senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and that's an editorially independent news organization at the Kaiser Family Foundation. And Mary Agnes Carey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. So let's tear this all apart, if we can, during the hour, and let's begin with the House bill. How is this bill able to cover something like 96% of Americans?
It offers subsidies to individuals up to 400% of the poverty level. And here you're talking about, that's about $88,000 a year of income for a family of four. It would expand the federal Medicaid program to about 150% of the federal poverty level. And here again, for comparison, that's about $16,000 for an individual and about $33,000 for a family of four. So that would expand the Medicaid program, provide subsidies to help people buy coverage through the health insurance exchange. Those are two key elements for the expansion to help get more people covered.
And what kind of assistance for small business if this is a mandate?
That's right. It's for small business. If you're up to $500,000 a year of payroll, you would be exempt from the employer mandate. But then it would be phased in up to about $750,000 a year, and then you'd pay a surcharge of about 8%, I believe it is, from that point on for the mandate. But there's also small business, to your point, small business tax credits to help them purchase coverage.
And what about the public option? And, of course, in the bills on both sides of Congress have a different approach to this. But what kind of consensus was Nancy Pelosi able to get on this public option?
She had to go to one for negotiated rates. Many progressives had preferred paying based on Medicare rates with a possible add-on. But when it came down to talking to a lot of moderate Democrats and Democrats representing rural areas, they said, look, Medicare rates are Medicare rates plus 5% aren't going to cut it for folks in our districts. So they had to go to negotiated rates on the House side. On the Senate side, they also would have negotiated rates. But Senator Harry Reid, as you mentioned earlier, has a plan to allow states to opt out of the public option if they don't like it. That opt-out provision is not part of the House plan at all.
What does that mean by negotiated rates? How would that work?
What that would work is the public plan operating entity would have to go in to a particular state and talk to doctors and to hospitals and other healthcare providers and negotiate a rate with them versus saying, we will pay you this amount. They'd have to talk with hospitals and doctors and providers to get them into the network and negotiate a payment rate based on what they want and what they believe the public plan wants to pay and so on. So it would be like a negotiation like private insurers have with providers.
Does that mean that the rates would be then higher than what Medicare would have paid?
That's the implication, that will be higher than Medicare because the market force of negotiation would kick in there, and doctors and hospitals and other providers could state what they want, which is, as you say, is expected to be higher than the Medicare rates.
Now, Nancy Pelosi came up with one figure for what she thought this plan would cost. The CBO came up with another plan, and I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but a lot of this is about, affordability and keeping it under a certain amount of money.
Right. There's the gross cost of the bill, and there's the net cost of the bill. So the gross cost is just over $1 trillion, but the net, which again would add in money they would collect from the House, there would be a surcharge on high income earners, people $500,000 of an individual income and $1 million for couples. The penalties they would collect from employers that don't participate and individuals don't participate, the revenue raisers, if you will, are going to reduce the cost of that bill to $894 billion over the next decade. And as we know, when President Obama addressed Congress, he said, I want a health plan that is $900 billion or less. Mm-hmm. So that's why you heard that $894 figure from last week.
And those are the, and that's the number that the both sides of Congress are trying to stay under?
Yes, yes, exactly. In the Senate bill, you have a bill that is of $829 billion. That's their gross for the Senate Finance Committee. I should be specific here. The net would be far lower, about $518. But as you mentioned in your intro, in the Senate side, they're trying to combine. Harry Reid and Democratic leadership are trying to take a bill passed by the Finance Committee and one passed by the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, or HELP Committee for short, combine them into one bill, and he sent off to the Congressional Budget Office, which is the official scorekeeper of Congress, a list of options for them to score, and from those, he'll combine them into a bill and introduce it at some point. We don't know exactly when.
Can the CBO or anyone project 10 years into the future when trying to figure out the cost of health care in this country?
That's a great question. They have very thorough analysis. It's very intense analytic methods, but at the end of the day, it is a very well-educated guess. Right. And so that's they have to always make that clear that this is an estimate of what will happen.
But that's where both sides of Congress go to get these numbers. So at least there's consistency there.
Exactly. They're viewed as they are a nonpartisan agency. Republicans and Democrats alike submit legislation, and it's very important for members of Congress want to see what the CBO says on a bill, mm-hmm. and especially on the health care bill. Leadership on both sides of the Capitol, Democratic leaders have said, we will have a CBO score for you before this bill goes to the floor. So that's why they have such mm-hmm. a critical role.
There's been so much focus on the public option, but I want to scale that back a bit, because when you look at the bills, you realize that the public option, as I understand it, is for people, as it stands today, for people who do not have health insurance. Am I correct on
right.
that?
Right. And then also small businesses will be allowed to purchase into that. President Obama and Democratic leadership in both chambers of Congress wanted to they were very concerned about disrupting the employer-based system, where something like 180 million Americans currently get their health insurance from their employer. So they put in what in Washington we call firewalls into the bill, certain hurdles that must be met before you can buy through the exchange. And here we're talking about individuals who don't have coverage and small businesses that would be allowed to buy in. So it's not like we could all just go into the exchange when it becomes effective, it'd be 2013 in both bills, and start buying your health care coverage.
And the CBO came out with some reporting believing that when and if this public option goes through, not a lot of people are going to end up choosing it. Again, do I have that right?
That's right. In the House bill, when the CBO scored it last week, they said 30 million people buying through the exchanges. Of that, 6 million would buy through the public plan. And so it's a very interesting finding, because Republicans and health insurance companies and other opponents of the public plan have said that they firmly believe over time more and more people will go to the public option, because it will be viewed as a less affordable option, because at that point, again, we were talking about payment at Medicare rates, which is mm-hmm. not the case, but that the public option would drown out the private insurance industry and trump it over time. But here we have the CBO saying by 2019, that's not the case. You're talking about 6 million people.
Because it won't be as affordable as people thought it might be?
That's right. It won't be as affordable as people thought it might be. You may also not have, I'll use a technical term but explain it, the intense utilization review that you have in the mm-hmm. private sector. The thought from the CBO was that perhaps because your administrative costs would be lower in a public plan, that you wouldn't have the same sort of scrutiny over claims, what you pay and what you don't pay, as what currently exists in the private market. And let's also remember, as a public option is being introduced into a market, they're kind of the new kids on the block. You will have lots of insurers that know they can go in and negotiate with the hospitals, physicians, and other providers. They can say, we have this amount of market share. We demand this kind of discount. With this kind of enrollment, the public plan may not be able to get the lower rates and lower mm-hmm. costs than one thought they could as much.
On the House side, and we will get to the Senate side, but on the House side, what are the Republicans offering as an alternative to the Democratic plan?
They have talked about a proposal. They have also sent theirs to CBO, so we haven't seen the actual legislative language, but you can expect it to be far different in size and scope and cost than the Democratic plan. For example, yesterday they talked about they would not have language barring pre-existing conditions. That is in both Senate bills and the House Democrats' bill. House Republicans are not going to put that in there. They would have a state, they wouldn't have an individual mandate. You wouldn't have an employer mandate. Mm-hmm. They want to have state high risk pools. They want to allow businesses to combine resources and buy health insurance across state lines. And they say they want to have more reforms to control health care costs. The debate over controlling health care costs is a very vibrant one in health reform because everyone agrees that it has to happen. But there are concerns that the pending bills, while they do have some measures aimed at growing, at slowing the growth of health care costs, it doesn't do enough. And Republicans say that they want to have a bill that does more of that. One other element I should add, Republicans will have, I'm sure, a medical malpractice caps. Right. It's not in either of the Democratic bills. It could be offered in the Senate as an amendment. You may have people that in the House that want to amend. It's harder to do amendments on the House floor, but they may want to change. We'll see a manager's amendment from Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, before that bill goes to the floor. But I don't expect to see any medical malpractice caps in that either.
And looking on the on the Senate side, we talked a little bit about this opt-out option.
Right.
But what else is being discussed on that side of the Congress?
There's a tax on high-cost health insurance policies. We're talking here right now, the threshold they have is about a policy that would be, you know, $8,000 for an individual and $21,000 a year for a family. That is one measure to put this. It's a 40% excise tax.
Right.
That's viewed by analysts as a way to help control healthcare costs because you're encouraging, or discouraging rather, the sale of these very generous plans that, in the eyes of many, encourage overuse. That's something in the Senate plan you're not going to see in the House plan. The Senate plan has a less generous formula for subsidies, and I know you have someone coming on later to talk about affordability. That's different. And also in the Senate plan, the Medicaid expansion is not as large. It's about 133% of the poverty level. And so that's some of the key differences there between the two plans.
And as the nation essentially watches what Congress does, what they have to do is reconcile these various bills and provisions, come to some kind of consensus on one bill, this would be the Democrats, and then get that bill to the president.
That's right. And this is where it's, you talked about sausage making in your intro.
Yes.
It was a perfect analogy because that's exactly what's going to happen. House Democrats, for example, want to pass their bill by Veterans Day. Whether or not they'll be able to do that is still an open question. But the way the House works, the majority kind of controls what gets on the floor and what doesn't. And in most cases, party leaders of the majority party in the House, in this case it's Democrats, they're not going to put that bill on until they know they have the votes. The really harder part here, I think, is in the Senate, because as we noted earlier, Harry Reid has sent a number of options to CBO. He sent them last week. Now some of the Democratic sources in the Senate are saying we may not hear from CBO this week. Veterans Day is coming. Congress typically goes home for a few days at Veterans Day. That's next week. So even if we had a bill introduced the week after, Thanksgiving is the following week. And Senate Republicans have pledged a very vigorous and fierce floor debate that they say could take as many as 4 weeks. So once both chambers pass a bill, you have something called a House and Senate conference, typically, where they try to meld the two. And so we'll have to keep watching the timing on that.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Mary Agnes Carey, our guest in this hour of Radio Time, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and we are deconstructing healthcare legislation. And waiting in the wings, we've got Alan Weil, executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy, getting a state perspective on healthcare legislation. Much more to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Mainline Health supports WHYY. Lankinall Hospital, part of Mainline Health, is a certified primary stroke center. While prompt treatment of stroke is critical, preventing stroke is a key aspect of the approach at Lankinall. That means providing access to a range of specialists who can help identify and manage risk factors. Stroke is the third leading cause of death in the U.S., but 80% of strokes are preventable. The key is knowing the facts and taking the right steps to reduce your risks. More at mainlinehealth.org/stroke.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. It's 10:20. Ahead in the second hour at 11, writer Anne C. Heller discusses her new book entitled Ayn Rand and the World She Made. This afternoon's forecast, plenty of sunshine, high 62 degrees. Clear skies overnight, low falling back to a frosty 36. Tomorrow, sunny to start, a couple of clouds later in the day, Wednesday's high 53 degrees, and then showers possible by Thursday. Thursday's high around 52.
Supporting WHYY, Rosemont School of the Holy Child, an independent co-ed school nursery to 8th grade. Announcing an open house Wednesday, November 4th, 9 to 11 a.m. with tours of their new academic center and gymnasium. Rosemont School offers extended day for children in nursery to 6th grade, transportation, and financial aid upon request. Rosemont School, nurturing excellence in a joyful Catholic community for 60 years. More at rosemontschool.org or 610-922-1010.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Coyne doing yet another program on healthcare legislation as it makes its way through Congress. And lines open. Any questions or comments you might have at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. As I said, Mary Agnes Carey with us for the hour, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And joining us now is Alan Weil. He's the executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. And Alan Weil, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Do we have Alan Weil? We need to pull him up. Do we have him? No. Okay, we're going to try to figure that out. Let me go back to you, Mary Agnes Carey, because I'm curious, and this is just sort of looking at some of the things that have been going on in Congress. Do you think Congress is kind of kicking the can back to the states to deal with some of these tough issues?
Well, it's a great point. I know Alan can expand upon that. But for example, in the Senate finance bill, the exchanges would be done on a state basis. States would have a lot more control than in the House bill. It's done on more of a national basis. And even getting back to the public plan option, the opt-out, having a state opt-out, when you first hear that, it sounds, the states will make the choice. But as we looked into it, my colleagues, Eric Pien and Julie Appleby and I just did a story on this, talking about, some of the political difficulties of that. There's simply the mechanics. Most state legislatures meet for a limited amount of time. They'd have to consume a lot of their time with debating this, and they'd have to have – state legislatures would have to act. There's not a lot we know about the opt-out option, but that's one of them. And then some conservatives say, wait a minute, my folks would have to still assume new taxes and new costs of implementing health reform, and now you're going to ask me to tell them that they can't have the benefits of a public option and other things. So it's a little bit harder than it seems.
Well, let me get to Alan Weil in on the conversation. Alan, sorry about that, and welcome to Radio Times.
No, we thank you very much.
Okay, no, I'm glad to have you here. That was a little scary pause there. No, thanks for joining us. I mean, I'm assuming state governments are watching what's going in Washington, but do they feel as if, and I put this to Mary Agnes Carey, do they feel as if Congress is going to toss some of the hard work back to the states?
Oh, I think states expect to do a lot of the hard work, but they've been doing that for a long time. States determine eligibility for public programs. They run those programs, although they get financial support from the federal government. So they're quite worried about the financial aspects and the many roles they're going to have to play. But I don't think from a state perspective this was unexpected.
And by financial aspects, I can imagine what you're referring to, but what are you referring to?
Well, of course, the largest concern from a state fiscal perspective is that there's a major expansion of the Medicaid program, and while both the House and the Senate anticipate that the federal government will pick up the very, very large share of that cost, even a small amount is hard for states to imagine taking on right now.
Right now meaning when states are struggling to try to balance budgets and pay for ongoing programs.
Exactly.
Looking at this notion coming from the Senate about opting out, if that becomes the law and states are given that option of opting out of a public plan, what do you imagine the country then looking like if that becomes the way people can get into this public option?
Well, I think until we know more about how that works, it will be hard to give a definitive answer to your question. It is, however, just one of quite a few features of the legislation that are going to vary state by state. And so while we will have, as envisioned by both the House and the Senate, a new higher federal minimum on Medicaid eligibility and a very comprehensive set of financial subsidies for families to purchase insurance, and that those will be uniform around the country, there are still so many aspects of program administration, regulation, outreach and enrollment processes, and many other aspects that will vary across the states. So I would put the opt-out provision as one of a number of areas where we would expect state variability to still exist after federal reform. It's getting a lot of attention now, but there are others as well.
Well, and Mary Agnes Carey, let me get you to weigh in on that. Are you able to read the tea leaves on this, so to speak?
On which, I'm sorry, which particular?
The idea of opting, you know, states having the option of opting out of a public plan.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's in the Senate, we're going to have to see if support exists for that. I mean, I think that you've got it very clear in the House that Democrats don't want an opt-out provision. Mm-hmm. There are some in the Senate that may feel it's too onerous, and they may prefer another Washington term, a trigger. This is something you mentioned Olympia Snowe earlier. She is interested in a approach that would say if in a given state you didn't have affordable health care coverage, and again, affordable has to be defined, available to 95% of people in a particular state, then the public option would be triggered. It may turn out that there's more support for that in the Senate than this opt-out provision, but as Alan states, we need more specificity on mm-hmm. both of these things, I think, people can before they can really judge them.
Alan, while I was reading about a number of states, including Alabama, and my understanding that Blue Cross Blue Shield essentially has a corner on most of the market in Alabama, first of all, am I correct about that?
I don't know the Alabama market well enough to confirm that, sorry.
But is it fair to say that there are some states where there really is competition between health insurance companies, and some states where maybe one company really has a corner on the market?
It's certainly true, although as we're looking to try to improve how healthcare is actually delivered, which is what really matters to people's health, competition among insurance companies isn't always a critical aspect of the kind of improvement we want to see. In fact, in some of the less populated states where there is a dominant carrier, it creates opportunities for cooperation among hospitals and physicians and nurses and others to meet the population needs where they don't have enough resources. Competition in that kind of a context isn't necessarily helpful. So it's certainly the case that the price competition that we would want to see across insurance products is not going to emerge as strongly in states with only one or two carriers. But some of the coordination that we want to see so that we don't have so much waste in the healthcare system is actually easier where there are fewer players.
And I'm curious, looking at Massachusetts, which has been experimenting with coverage in that state, are there some lessons from that state that you think can be applied to the rest of the country at all, Alan?
Oh, there are more lessons than there's time to talk about. Just at the outset, I would say, you know, for all the criticism that people heap upon them, they have been wildly successful beyond anyone's expectations in dramatically reducing the number of people without health insurance, which was their primary goal. It is expensive, but no one is surprised by that. No one inside the state thought they could do this for free. And covering everyone doesn't immediately bring down healthcare costs, but it creates a platform for the kinds of conversations and choices that are necessary if we're going to have those costs come down. I think from a national perspective, the biggest lesson for Massachusetts is don't expect miracles to happen on day one. It takes a lot of time and energy and effort and commitment to make this work, and you're not going to get everything right the first time. You have to give it some room to succeed. Now, Massachusetts had a bipartisan commitment to making this work. And one of my fears is that if this is viewed as a partisan victory for one party in Washington and is attacked from day one by a whole cadre of folks who wish it hadn't happened, there's just not going to be a lot of room to fix what will inevitably be the challenges that arise in implementation.
Well, let me go back to you, Mary Agnes Carey. Is there any bipartisanship in the U.S. Congress on this issue of health care?
Right now, I don't think in the House you're going to see any Republican votes for the Democrats' plan. Now, in the Senate, Olympia Snowe did vote with, and again, she's a moderate from Maine, a Republican, did vote with Senate Finance Democrats at the committee consideration deliberations of the bill for final passage. But she made it pretty clear at the time to the chairman of the committee, Max Baucus of Montana, just because you have my vote now doesn't mean you'll have my vote later. She does not agree with this idea of an opt-out for the public plan. Nonetheless, Harry Reid, the majority leader in the Senate, I'm sure will continue to reach out to Olympia Snow, to Susan Collins, to anyone else he can in the Republican Party to get some support. But it's not going to be a broad, you're not going to have a big section of Senate Republicans if you even have one or two at the most that go with this bill.
And Alan, before we say goodbye to you, final question, what are you looking at and watching as this health care legislation makes its way through Congress?
Well, we're not lobbyists. We are a support organization for state officials who will have the job no matter what comes out of making it work. And so what we're primarily focused on is trying to understand the many, many roles states will play and to prepare states and the federal government for the investment in an infrastructure of support that will be necessary. We can pass all the laws we want, but until people on the ground actually put these programs in place, find and enroll people, administer the subsidies to make coverage affordable, negotiate with health plans to set up these exchanges so people have new opportunities for coverage, help find providers so that the new enrollees in Medicaid actually can receive services. Until those things happen, no one is going to see any benefits from the legislation. So our focus really is on making sure we have as good an understanding of, as possible of what the state roles are, and then try to line up the kinds of public and private support that will be necessary so that they can do as good a job as possible given the cards they're dealt.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Alan Weil, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
He's the executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. Mary Agnes Carey staying with us for the rest of the hour. She's been our guest for the full hour, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. I should add that's an editorially independent news organization of the Kaiser Family Foundation. And she's helping us deconstruct the healthcare legislation in the House and the Senate and the issues at stake, how it might play out nationally and certainly how it has been playing out in states as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments or be curious also what you're looking for when it comes to healthcare legislation, do give us a call here at WHYY. Mary Agnes Carey, there's so much focus and so much talk about the cost of these various programs, but what's the cost of not doing anything, of just keeping the system that we have?
Well, it will be guaranteed that health insurance premiums will continue their climb. Sometimes, you know, it's interesting when health insurance premiums just go up 7 or 8% a year, people are like, wow, wasn't double digits, you know, which it had been for a while. So they'll continue to climb. With the economic downturn still very prevalent, I think you'll see more people will continue to lose their health insurance. Most of us get our health insurance through our jobs. And as you lose your job, you lose your health insurance. There's been efforts to have subsidies to help people continue something, this program called COBRA that allows you to continue your health insurance through your former employer. So I think you'll still see premiums increased. You'll still see people losing their jobs due to the economic downturn. And you'll still have the uninsured who still need help. And the thought is, one issue in this is the whole idea of the individual mandate. It's stronger in the House bill than it is in the Senate finance bill. But the thought is, if you get people into the system, and the level of penalties you assess for them not to is a separate debate, but
sure,
the more people you get in the system, the lower cost will be, because if you have health insurance, ostensibly you get preventive care, you use your preventive care, and you avoid those emergency room trips for things that could have been avoided, which reduce costs for everyone.
I heard a story of a small business person, someone that does insure the numbers of people that works in his office, and he just got an announcement that his insurance rates were going up like 40%.
That happens all the time. The House Democrats had a very, you know, a very big press conference, very prestigious, on the west front of the Capitol last week, and they had folks get up and tell these personal stories they're a small business person. Somebody in the group had cancer. Insurance premiums went way up, or even for a reason that wasn't, as you couldn't point to one particular medical event. Small business in particular really struggles with this, and trying to make it easier for small businesses to purchase health insurance coverage is something both Democrats and Republicans want in this debate.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation, and we've got Claudia, and Claudia joins us from Fairmount. Claudia, go ahead, you're in Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for this very interesting program.
You're welcome.
I have a couple of questions. The first one is, what happens to the Medicare population under any health care reform scenario, but particularly one where you have a public option that pays better than Medicare? Right now, a lot of seniors are having trouble finding doctors who will accept Medicare because the physician reimbursement rates have been pushed so low that they don't feel they want to take any more Medicare patients.
Sure.
But you're getting ready to have a big demographic shift, a big bump up in the elderly population seeking care as people age. So what's going to happen with them? It looks like they're going to be caught in a catch-22 where they can't opt out of Medicare, they can't find health insurance, other health insurance at their age, but they also can't find providers who will take them. So is this going to be a new population resorting extensively to emergency rooms?
Well, you know, Claudia, let me take that first point because it's an important one. You've laid it out in very careful terms, and I want to get Mary Agnes Carey to respond. Go ahead, Mary Agnes.
How Medicare pays physicians, which the caller talks about, is a critical element of this debate. And there's a formula called the sustainable growth rate. I won't get into all that, but it dictates how Medicare physicians are paid. And for the last several years, physicians were supposed to have a payment cut, and they, of course, are not very happy about that, because as the caller notes, a lot of doctors don't necessarily like Medicare reimbursement. They won't take new Medicare patients. Congress knows it has to fix this particular payment problem, but it's an expensive proposition. On both sides of the Capitol, Democrats had a more extensive fix proposed. They wanted to try to settle this thing for the next 10 years. It costs a ton of money. And we'll have to see how it comes out, but I think that what they'll do is try to give Medicare physicians additional money for the next year or so and come back and revisit that. But to her point about how Medicare pays providers, I think she's absolutely hit on an essential point, because the baby boom generation is growing.
That's right.
More people are going into Medicare. If you have hospitals and physicians that say Medicare underpays them, that pressure will only grow as more baby boomers mature and age into Medicare. But the thing about this is Medicare is also growing as a program. It's growing at a fairly fast rate every year. And so as part of health reform, Democrats are trying to look at the program, suggest changes that would, in many cases, try to link the quality of care delivered, link the payment rather to the quality of care delivered versus just simply paying per service. And so the hope is that they'll look at Medicare and make these adjustments and make these payment changes that will make the program more efficient and perhaps make providers happy with their reimbursement as time goes on.
Claudia, we have to take a very short break, and I do want to move on, and I appreciate your call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about health care legislation, the issues in both the House and Senate as Congress debates this bill. And again, Mary Agnes Carey, our guest for the hour, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. We've got Judith Solomon waiting in the wings, senior fellow for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. We'll be talking about this issue of affordability. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Cooper University Hospital's Heart Institute is a proud supporter of WHYY, the only academic medical center in southern New Jersey. Cooper Heart Institute provides a full range of advanced cardiovascular care, from cardiac surgery to comprehensive testing and treatment from outpatient centers located throughout South Jersey. Details about Cooper Heart Institute programs and services are available at 1-800-8-COOPER or online at cooperheart.org.
It's 10:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. In the second hour at 11, author Anne C. Heller discusses her new book entitled Ayn Rand and the World She Made. Today's forecast, sunny skies, this afternoon's high 62 degrees, down to 36 overnight. Tomorrow, sunny to start, a couple of clouds roll in the afternoon, Wednesday's high 53. Rain possible on Thursday, high 52 degrees, and Friday, partly cloudy, high again around 52.
JerseyArts.com supports WHYY, featuring details on Grounds for Sculpture, located in the heart of central New Jersey, offering hundreds of outdoor contemporary sculptures year-round on 35 landscaped acres, with gallery exhibits, fine dining, concerts, classes, and more. Directions and a calendar of fall and holiday events are available on the web at groundsforsculpture.org. Grounds for Sculpture and more online at JerseyArts.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, we are talking about the healthcare legislation making its way through the U.S. Congress with Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And joining us now is Judith Solomon, senior fellow for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And Judith Solomon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, let's talk about affordability, an issue that hasn't gotten as much press attention as, for instance, the public option. But as you look at affordability, what are some of the concerns that you and your organization have?
Well, I think the first thing, you make a very important point about not getting enough attention. And for us, it really is at the center of health reform and whether our efforts are going to be successful. If you look at why are people uninsured today, you see the bulk of them have relatively low incomes, and for the most part, it's because they can't afford coverage. So getting a system where people can get some help with premiums to pay for coverage and also have coverage that does not require them to pay a lot of out-of-pocket to get care is really a central focus. If we don't have coverage affordable, then a lot of the other key pieces of health reform start to fall apart. We heard, you know, the concerns about whether we can maintain market reforms like requiring that insurers sell to everyone and don't require people to wait for coverage of pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. All those assumed are for the all those are necessary to have affordable coverage so people actually participate.
Well, what is the definition of affordable? Is it a certain amount of money, a percentage of income? And I should add that the median family income in this country is something like $50,000.
Yeah, I mean, most of the bills do approach the affordability of coverage from a percentage of income. There's nothing that really says a particular amount is going to be affordable for everyone. As you know, people's circumstances vary. So some people may be able to afford more than others, even with the same income. But the bills do all come at this from the perspective of figuring out a percentage of income that people would have to pay.
And Mary Agnes Carey, as you look at the House and Senate bills, how does this issue of affordability show up?
It's predominant, and I think it will only, as we move to the debate in both chambers to the floors, it will only become more predominant, because how can you mandate someone has to have health insurance coverage if they can't afford it? Right. And to your earlier point, what is affordability? And one family might be able to handle a certain level of premiums and co-payments, deductibles, and another one may not. So it's one of those critical issues that will have to be a part of the debate and will be part of the debate. And I think you'll hear a lot about it on the floor of both the House and the Senate.
Because, and I know, Judith Solomon, your organization, you know, ran some numbers looking at, I believe it was on the Senate side, on this issue of affordability. But again, you know, I'm trying to imagine a family, let's say, of four people with an income of something like $50,000. It seems to me that what's affordable is going to be a pretty small amount of money.
I think that's right for many families at that income level. And, you know, the work that we did really on looking at the Senate finance bill, the bill that was reported out, was really raising concerns on exactly that point, that particularly at the lower end of the scale, the people with the lowest incomes, they would be asked to pay, you know, substantial amounts. For example, you know, a family, as you said, you know, a family of four, with about $50,000 a year would probably be in the range of having to pay, you know, 7 or 8% of their income for coverage, which, you know, when you do the dollars, it doesn't sound like a lot, but when you think about all the other expenses that a family like that would have at that income level, you realize it's a pretty heavy lift. And then the other part of the equation is looking at what kind of coverage they would be buying and, you know, would there be deductibles and other charges before they even were able to get care. So that's really the focus that we've been trying to get people to really look at. And as Mary Agnes pointed out, I mean, I think this is central to the mandate because you can't require people to get coverage unless it's affordable. One of the things that happened in the Senate is they actually exempt a lot of people now. If, you know, if you would pay more than 8% of your income, you would be able to be exempt from having to pay a penalty for not having coverage. And that's, you know, that's good in the sense that you don't want to force people to do something they can't afford, but it's troubling because it really weakens the whole notion that everybody's going to participate in, and in that way we can get insurers to agree to sell to everybody, because they're not going to sell to everybody if they think people can wait till they get sick.
And to you, Mary Agnes, Carrie, this goes back to what we talked about at the top of the hour about subsidies, looking at, you know, the poverty level and how much the government is willing to help families, individuals pay for health care insurance.
Right. Exactly. I mean, if as they cobble together the support and what people want and how much they expect to have, I mean, if there's a real feeling that the bills are simply asking too much of a middle-class family, and remember, this has been played politically as a benefit to the middle class. Right. The health reform will help you. It will control your costs. It will help you get health insurance if you don't have it. It will help you keep what you have and help control the growth of your costs. They could do a lot of tinkering with the subsidies to make this more politically palatable, but that also affects the cost of the bill. So I think it's one of those things that as they negotiate and they look at where they can get support. We talked about Olympia Snow earlier. In the Finance Committee markup, she was very against mandating coverage that could not be affordable. Mm-hmm. So that's where the exemption from the mandate came in, if it's more than 8% of your income to pay a premium. That's why in the Finance Committee bill, they're not going to have the mandate financial penalty doesn't kick in for the first year, and then it's phased in at $250, phasing up to $750 over like a four-year period. That could have some policy consequences, as Judith pointed out, well.
And I do want to get to our callers, but we do have the most expensive healthcare system in the world. Am I right with that, Mary Agnes, Gary?
You are right.
I mean, and if the goal is to try to rein in some of these costs, I mean, if you include more people, that is one way to doing that. Perhaps there are efficiencies, prevention. I mean, is the goal in the long term to try to figure out how to corral some of the driving costs of healthcare, Mary Agnes Carey?
Right. You know, how do you control usage? How do you control incentives for overusage? How do you make sure that a lot of people in this debate, they talk about the Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic and how efficient they are, and those doctors and nurses and other employees are paid on a salary. They're not billing by the service, which is kind of the incentive, whether you're in Medicare or many private insurers, depending on the policies, there's a real incentive there to do more and bill more and get more money. And so we have to kind of bending the cost growth curve. You've got to change the incentives to change the growth in healthcare costs and get them down over time.
Judith Selman, I'd be curious about your perspective. How do we rein in overall healthcare costs in this country? Then we'll get to our callers.
Well, I think there are, you know, a number of things that are in the bill, payment reforms in Medicare. I think, you know, those are the things that you have to look at because, you know, we're talking here about affordability and coverage, but, you know, cost is the other part. And related to the affordability, all the bills actually, over time, people would have to pay more of their income. Premiums grow faster than income. That's what people are seeing now today, and that would be carried forward in these bills. Mm-hmm. So essentially, everybody's going to have a stake in keeping those costs down because, you know, if we're concerned now at the baseline affordability is how much people have to pay, that would actually get more challenging over time if we continue to see the cost growth that we're seeing now.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. We've got Paul joining us on his way to Toronto. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
All right, Marty, thanks for taking my call.
You're
welcome. I hope the signal's good. I'm on a cell phone here.
You're doing okay.
I think everybody's missing one other big aspect of that that turns this in somewhat of a win-win situation. Think of a businessman who has the opportunity to sell to 50 million consumers, essentially the uninsured or we have now. The amount of jobs that it would create providing a service to those 50 million consumers, I would imagine, is somewhere in the order of 1 to 2% of that. So we're talking about 500,000 to 1 million jobs for new healthcare professionals in this country. That's more than like in the steel industry was, etc. These are people who you take off the unemployment roll, put into educated jobs, you give them a little job training, etc. These now become taxpayers. They are no longer unemployed, they're no longer a burden. You now wind up with 500,000 to 1 million more taxpayers. That's a great win-win, and in fact, reduces the overall cost of health care.
Well, Paul, I appreciate the call. Let me get to Mary Agnes Carey to respond to your comments. Mary Agnes, go ahead.
I think he makes a great point. There are a lot of people on Capitol Hill that say, look, bringing coverage to millions of uninsured Americans will bring more business for the health insurance company, more business for the pharmaceutical industry. It'll increase hospitals will have less uncompensated care. They'll have people that are covered, and that this will be a very, very positive effect for individuals, for their lives, and also for all these healthcare sectors. So I think the caller's right on.
Do you agree with that, Judith Solomon?
Yes, I do.
Let me get Tom from Florida to join us. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
My comment is on the Medicare reduction in physician payments that is a part of the separate bill that's going through.
Right.
As we know, Medicare is composed of two components. Medicare Advantage plans, which require a higher subsidy to the insurance companies than original Medicare, and the original Medicare plan. Wouldn't it be advantageous to get rid of the Medicare Advantage plans and take those subsidy monies and apply them to physician payments?
That's an interesting question, and I think I heard you say something, Mary Agnes Carey. Go ahead.
Right. Both in both bills, what they would do is reduce how much is Medicare Advantage plans receive. Again, these are the private insurers in Medicare. The research shows that on average they're paid about 14% more per beneficiary than beneficiaries in the traditional service, fee-for-service program. Now, they're taking those savings, they being the Democrats, in both bills and applying them, I think, towards the subsidies expansion and the Medicaid expansion. And you certainly could have made the decision, if you were writing the bills, to use it to help correct the physician payment discrepancy in Medicare to stop those cuts. The problem with doing away with Medicare Advantage is it now covers about a fourth of Medicare beneficiaries.
Wow.
And so you have a lot of people in the country, 10, around 13 million, I think, that are in it. And so that means that when there are, if for example, these reductions, these cuts to Medicare Advantage are viewed as too onerous, you're going to have pressure on lawmakers, Democrats and Republicans alike, that will may come back and try to, well, there's some right now that don't want Medicare Advantage to be cut, but if that does happen and the bill is implemented, they may be pushing for those reimbursements to come back, because depending how this, again, if the bill passed and if the plans were cut, depending how the insurers, the private insurers and Medicare implemented their policies from that point, would dictate the possible political pressure. You know what I mean?
I know. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
You know what I mean.
And Tom, thanks for calling into Radio Times. That's Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Judith Solomon, senior fellow for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, talking about health care and affordability. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to WHYY. Why? Judith Solomon, anything you want to add to that, to what Mary Agnes Carey was just saying?
No, I think she, you know, got it exactly right. There certainly would be, you know, some political repercussions for eliminating the Medicare Advantage program altogether.
But it would save money.
It would save money because the plans are paid more than on a, you know, per beneficiary basis than the fee-for-service Medicare program.
Let me get Marcy from Lincoln University to join our conversation. Marcy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I have a question about access. I work at a freestanding occupational and physical health clinic, and if it does you if no good to have insurance if a provider doesn't accept it. So I wondered if there was anything in the bills that will mandate that providers, hospitals, doctors, whatever, take this public option, or, you know, that they accept it. Because if the place you want to go doesn't take your insurance, then you can't get treatment there.
Mary Agnes Gary, you want to respond to that?
I want to say, and Judith, please correct me if I'm wrong, I want to say in earlier versions of the House Democrats' plan, they were saying if you took Medicare, you would have to accept the public option. But I think that is gone.
That's correct.
Is that right?
Right now,
okay.
I think it would not be required. And, you know, the plan also, the original version would have tied payment of the plan to Medicare rates plus 5%. Mm-hmm. Now, there will be negotiations with the plan between providers, and the assumption is, you know, the result of that negotiation will be an agreement to participate. So I think that's the way it will work out.
And we're almost out of time here. And again, to you, Judith Solomon, something I asked Alan Weil, what are you then watching as Congress debates healthcare legislation?
Well, I think there's a number of things. Certainly, we've been watching very closely the, you know, the affordability of coverage. We've been watching the Medicaid expansion and the sort of terms and conditions around that, seeing the House have more people go into Medicaid, seeing the House with a stronger overall subsidy scale. You know, we've been watching the coverage numbers and the you know, terms of the mandate and just a many, many details in this bill. I don't personally, but we've been working very closely on the financing side. What are the offsets? How are we going to pay for this? The excise tax, all the other pieces, the Medicare changes, and so on. So there's a lot to follow and a lot to worry about, and
indeed,
we hope to see it all come together.
And final question, same question to you, Mary Agnes Carey. You're in the thick of it. What are you looking at?
Right now, I'm watching the calendar and trying to figure out how in the world this is going to get done before Christmas. That's the goal, that they do it before the end of the year. And so I'm be watching a lot the negotiations between the leadership on both sides of the House and Senate, how they try to, I think, resolve differences between the bills before they have to go to a conference, and how this will all play out, especially in the Senate, where it's going to be a much more difficult road ahead.
Well, I appreciate both of you joining us today on Radio Times. Mary Agnes Carey, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Judith Solomon, thank you very much as well.
Thanks for having me, too. Thanks.
You're welcome. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and find out more about the program. Leave us an email. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org. Member-supported public media.